I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Melvin Rogers, professor of political science and associate director of philosophy, politics, and economics at Brown University. We're discussing his recent book, The Darkened Light of Faith, Race, Democracy, and Freedom in African-American Political Thought from Princeton University Press. Rogers' research is in contemporary democratic theory and the history of American and African-American political thought. He has published a monograph on John Dewey, several edited volumes, and articles on these topics. Well, first of all, Melvin Rogers, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you for having me.
Melvin, I loved this book. It's a great sweeping analysis of African-American political thought, specifically on the topic of democracy, really in-depth analyses of particular thinkers with a great narrative arc to it. So congratulations on the book. Let me ask you, first of all, what was the motivation for writing the book in the first place?
Well, first, again, thank you for having me. So I really appreciate you thinking about the book and me and inviting me on the show, because I've been listening to it for quite some time, and I had hoped to be invited. So thank you. The motivation. So I started thinking about this book as I was writing my first book on John Dewey. And in that first book, one of the themes that I trace is the sort of the place of uncertainty in John Dewey's sort of moral and political theorizing. And as I was coming on the end of that book, I started to think about, you know, that group in my mind that not only sort of thought about uncertainty, but sort of perpetually lived it in the context of a society that claimed to be democratic. And that group for me, African-Americans. And so I found myself thinking, you know, what is it about democracy for them that justify their faith in it? I mean, how did they understand democracy? And so that was sort of the first part of the motivation, an attempt just to sort of answer that question. I think the other part of it was that I really sort of I wanted a book that captured, I hope, the grandness of these extraordinary figures and their philosophical contributions to American democratic life. A book that viewed these thinkers not merely as strategists, as they were dealing with issues of inequality, although they were strategists, but strategists whose orientation was informed by deep thinking about human nature, about faith, about democracy, about art, about freedom, about equality. I don't know if I succeeded, but I am very certain that they're worthy of the attempt.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, and that's one of the things I should have said at the front, that I liked that what you did in the book, which was kind of weave together the theory and the practice in a nice way. This is one great thing about studying American political thought, is that you have this great occasion to have a lot of these thinkers who were deep theorists, but also great practitioners, and the figures in your book are no exception. So let me ask you about the kind of frame of the book, that you frame the book in terms of contemporary evaluations of American democracy, particularly from the perspective of Afro-pessimism. And I was wondering if you could say a little bit about Afro-pessimism and where you agree and disagree with that line of thinking, and how your book kind of gets launches from there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, of course, when I started the book about a decade ago, Afro-pessimism did not loom as large as it subsequently came to loom in the book. The motivations were what I had previously stated, and that was sort of fueling the structure of the book. But as it was sort of coming, as it was sort of unfolding, there was a kind of Afro-pessimistic thread that was emerging. One of the threads in the book, right, that I associate with the Black nationalist Martin Delaney. And so it made sense to sort of think about its contemporary counterpart as a way to situate and anchor sort of contemporary intellectual reader. So, I mean, Afro-pessimism in the American context is, I mean, the way I view it is really a kind of philosophical meditation on Blackness, on Black identity, and particularly the workings of Blackness, Black identity in the context of racism and colonialism. And Afro-pessimism is associated with contemporary figures like Frank Wilderson and Jared Sexton. And part of what I think this tradition believes that it discerns is the sort of the centrality or necessity, I would put it that way, right? The centrality or necessity of Blackness to modern discourse. And in particular, the necessity of Blackness as a category of subordination that helps to then render intelligible not only whiteness as a kind of ideological identity, but paradoxically for them, freedom and progress. And so for them, you know, modern discourse, modern life is broken because this is what's at its core. So I think as I, in the book, as we move across these figures, my sense is that many of them agree with the ways in which Black identity has been used as the background against which whiteness comes into view. But they do not agree at all, and I stand with them, that Blackness is a necessity in the way that the Afro-pessimists want to think about it. It is for these figures, whether it's David Walker or Frederick Douglass or James Baldwin, it's a contingent expression of modern life. And to that extent, Black identity can be understood and seen in very different ways, and ways that are affirmative. And we see this in a tradition of African-American political thought, which is, yes, Blackness as about struggle, but then there's Blackness that is about joy and beauty and love and all of these other wonderful sort of expanded ideas that we associate with human life. So I think that this divergence between the Afro-pessimists and this broader tradition that I'm tracing is, you know, my figures are sort of sensitive to the contradictions of modern life. But they see Black people as situated within modern life. They see them as interpreters of modern life, and they see them as political and moral contributions to transforming modern life.
Right, and I wanted to probe to that kind of positive contribution here, because yeah, right, it seems that, you know, I mean, one of the problems with the Afro-pessimism view is that it sort of disables a kind of agency on the part of the figures here. And agency, I think what the kind of agency, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the kind of agency that you're particularly interested in, and the figures that you examine are particularly interested in, are kind of the collective agency of the people, right? That sort of vision of democratic life. That's certainly not realized in practice in the 19th century, in the 20th century, maybe even now, but could be realized, the kind of ethical vision of democracy. You call it at some points sort of perfectionist vision of democracy. I was wondering maybe if you could, you know, give us a kind of overview of, you know, that view of a kind of ethical approach to democracy, and you know, am I right to think that that's the sort of locus of agency that you're focused on?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, the thing I would say before I sort of say something about the sort of ethical description of democracy, I mean, the thing that I would say about the Afro-pessimists is that on one reading of the various figures that comprise the tradition in its contemporary form, on one reading of it, it sometimes appears that they are providing you with a kind of historical analysis of the persistence of negative descriptions around Blackness that seemingly fuel modern and now contemporary life, But the more you probe, the more you realize is that this that the that the that the language of history is really a cover for this sort of deeper claim that they mean to make, a kind of ontological claim about the very sort of foundation of modern life itself. And it is not at all clear, if you sort of accept their move and if you accept these arguments, it's not at all clear how the individual or collective agency of Black people can get off the ground. Because these sort of negative ideas of their identity and the centrality of it to freedom and equality, ironically, paradoxically, seem to be far too expensive. But then it raises a question, well, then how do you make sense of what these Black folks are doing? How do we understand what they're doing, right? How do we make sense of the various inroads that they make? How do you make sense of the ways in which, even amid the persistence of white supremacy, the fact remains is that 2023 is not, you know, 1854. I mean, it just isn't the case. And so it seemed to me that something more had to be articulated about how these figures understand the vitality of democratic life. And this is how we get to this to the question that you asked, which is the sort of ethical description of democracy. So basically, I would say that what the book does across these figures is develop an understanding of democracy as a way of life. So these figures were not merely interested in the discourse of freedom and equality, the sort of pillars of democracy for them. They were not simply interested in the discourses of freedom and equality, as sort of merely those values that inform political institutions. They were also interested in the ways in which freedom and equality shape cultural horizon in which the inhabitants of the United States live and that shape the orientation of the citizenry toward each other. Right? So who do you take yourself to be? I mean, that's like a critical question for them, right? And so to think about democracy as a way of life is to get at the answer to that question. So freedom for these thinkers is about, you know, pursuing a plan of life without the sort of fear or threat of being subjected to arbitrary power, which is, you know, without the fear of threat of the fear or threat of being dominated. And I referred to equal regard in the book is the specific term I use, and regard, as I say, is a way of showing concern. And if you, to modify it with equal means that the concern you extend is not comparatively diminished in relation to others. And these figures are concerned with the ways in which those two values can come to shape at the deepest level of self and society the orientation toward Black people, and can shape it in such a way that even when the laws are silent, right, even when the laws are not active, one is living one's life in affirmation of that expansive freedom and of that equal regard. And they thought that this idea of freedom and equal regard created a space in American life of contestation, a space of contestation that could unsettle what the United States was at any particular time, and unsettle it in the service of trying to align it, right, with the demands of those values that it otherwise claims to adhere to. And it's in this description, I think, that they place. That they place their faith, and it's based on this that they advance their critiques of the United States.
Yeah, you've done work on John Dewey in the past. It sounds a little bit like Dewey's view of, you know, ethical view of democracy, where it's, you know, Dewey tries to move away a little bit from the liberal tradition of individualism, et cetera, and embraces more of a vision of democracy as a way of life. Is there some similarities and differences there? Or is that, I mean, I wonder if, you know, Dewey had some connection with this tradition that you're talking about.
Well, you know, I mean, obviously, in Dewey's, you know, in Dewey's past, so he knows W.E.B. Du Bois. He is involved in the establishment of the NAACP. So he's moving in these circles. But I don't, you know, from my perspective, I see these African American figures as working out the entailments of the wider American tradition. And in working out those entailments, they sort of bring or they offer up contributions. They reconfigure ideas that are in the tradition, but I see them as part and parcel of the tradition. And of course, this is the tradition to which Dewey belongs. So, you know, so well before, Dewey writes, Creative Democracy, the Task Before Us, well before that, we have David Walker and we have Frederick Douglass and we have Anna Julia Cooper thinking about democracy as a way of life, democracy as a way of talking about ethical life.
That's great. So, what did I ask you in terms of, I mean, to move into talking about some of the specific figures that you, the thinkers that you discuss, writers that you discuss? I mean, but just to maybe give us some sense of a kind of, methodological orientation, as it were. I mean, there are lots of figures in the African American political thought canon, I suppose. Maybe you could say a little bit about why you chose the particular thinkers that you did, and how your approach tends to fit in with other scholars who work on African American political thought.
Right, sure. So, I mean, in some ways, it's interesting in sort of how do we select? In some ways, I feel like the thinkers, selected me, as it were, right? So you're in the archive, and you're trying to sort of figure out this question, and you're trying to figure out whether or not the question is their question, and it begins to emerge that yes, this actually is their question, and some thinkers sort of step forward, as it were. Right. And so David Walker steps forward and, Mariah Stewart and Hosiah Easton step forward. Baldwin steps forward at the end. These figures are not the only figures that could be used to tell this story. So in the place of David Walker, one could be talking about Henry Highland Garnett. In place of Baldwin, one could be talking about Martin Luther King Jr. Or Howard Thurman. My hope is that the reader will understand that these figures, as I argue, are sort of illustrious of a tradition. And if one wanted to put it to the test, one should be able to go back to the archive and pull out, for example, other 19th century figures that can fit in the story and populate the story and thus fill it out. So these are the thinkers that in some sense presented themselves to me, and these are the thinkers that I then wanted the reader to think with me as I was thinking with those thinkers. And so that's really sort of how the book came about and how the figures emerged. I can tell you sort of specific stories about, David Walker publishes his pamphlet in 1829. It marks a transition in African American appeals. But in truth, David Walker wasn't the only one. His text was the most prominent one, but he wasn't the only one. So even that would not sort of settle the issue of selection. It seemed to me that there is this story about democracy as a way of life, that there is this sort of ethical vision of democracy. A great many African American thinkers subscribe to it. And these are the figures that I think nicely illustrate the tradition.
Yeah, that's great. So let's get into talking about David Walker. I was happy to learn about David Walker. You had several chapters on him, an important figure here. Could you give us kind of introduction to him as a political thinker, and give us a sense both of how his theory and his rhetoric kind of interact, because he was quite keenly attuned to the kind of rhetorical power of his pamphlets. One of his pamphlets is called appeal to the colored citizens of the world, which is, as you point out, very, very interesting use of citizen in the title, since African Americans, of course, were not citizens, in the United States, let alone many other places. So maybe give us a kind of general sketch here.
Right. So David Walker is born in 1796, Wilmington, North Carolina. His freedom follows the line of his mother, who's free. He makes his way up north, arriving in the 1820s in Boston, Massachusetts. There's a small African-American community there. And I think it is fair to say that his travel from Wilmington, North Carolina, up to Boston over a series of years, that really politicized him, and that really energized him. And so now in Boston, he thinks to himself, well, how do I join forces with others in striking a blow at the formal practices of slavery in the South and the informal practices of domination in the North? And so he writes the appeal to the colored citizens of the world, but in particular, very expressly of the United States. He writes this in 1829. And the point of the pamphlet, as he says, is to awaken his afflicted brethren. And this is a pamphlet which he says in the revision that he makes to it is, you know, that every man, woman, and child, every Black man, woman, and child should procure a copy and read it or have it read to them. Because he realized, you know, the issues around literacy. And the point was to awaken them to the demand of their freedom, even amid domination, that even amid domination, freedom is making a demand on you in these conditions, and you must rise to the occasion or prove your white counterparts right, that you are only fit for slavery. And it is a text in which he knows that that will get in the hands of his white readers, and there are lessons in the text for them as well. But this is a text that is essentially a defense of freedom. What does freedom demand of you in the face of domination?
Right. It reminds me, we'll turn to Frederick Douglass in a bit, but it reminds me a little bit of Frederick Douglass's approach, which is to assert a kind of dignity on the part of African Americans, but that dignity also must be sort of asserted in the world. It can't just simply be posited or assumed, and it's a sort of aspiration. It's an expectation that individuals have to take on. Do you see parallels there between Walker and Douglass, was Walker influential on Douglass in this way?
So I'd say two things. You know, both Walker and then later Douglass, there's a sort of necessity of performance to political and moral life. That and this is something that I think that they partly share with the classical tradition, which is that who you are is discovered in the habits that display itself in the world. Right, the way in which you live your life. And so Walker's claim is that, look, if we think that we're created in the image of God and we're endowed with freedom as a result, God has given us the capacity to lay claim to it. Now we must lay claim to it. And you do that through sort of asserting and performing that freedom, even in the face of those who would deny it. And so in this way, Walker and Douglass are very, very consistent. The other thing I would say is that I'm being a bit dramatic here, but I don't think it's, you know, I don't think it's inappropriate. But, you know, Frederick Douglass's 4th of July address, right? That address that's partly congratulatory in the beginning and quickly shifts to ridiculing his white audience and to shaming them. That approach really finds itself in the first instance in David Walker's appeal. Right? The David Walker's appeal marks a radical shift from deferential appeals that African Americans have had previously made. And it is a text that really believes that the denial of freedom requires that it be met with all of the condemnatory language that one could use. And so he rises to the occasion. Of course, Douglas follows suit in 1850. Douglas wasn't the only one. Henry Highland Garnett, Mariah Stewart, but Walker, I think, puts that in circulation. And Douglas, rightly in his own voice, identified David Walker as a transformative figure in African American political letters.
Yeah, great. And so as you sort of suggested there, I mean, there's a couple audiences in Walker's appeal. I mean, there's the sort of African-American appeal to sort of rise up and assert your freedom, but there's also the appeal to the white population. I was wondering if you could say a little bit about so how that appeal worked. I mean, there's a kind of appeal to the freedom on the part of African-Americans. Obviously, a lot of the white population is not going to be receptive to that kind of claim, right? So is this, I guess maybe it's a further question about the character of the audience, the white audience that he has in mind. Is this kind of a Northern audience that he's maybe someone who's more receptive to universal natural rights that are sketched out, say, in the Declaration? Or is this really intended to be a kind of appeal also even to the South?
So Walker, the pamphlet itself, initiated by Walker, it finds its way onto ships traveling south. Right? So Walker is trying to agitate all up the coast. And when you read the text, it is clear that he's speaking in the first instance to Black people, but it's also clear that Walker is testing the sensibilities of his white readers. So when he gives you early on, the text is comprised of four articles. When he gives you early on in Article 2, this description, and he says, look, the observer might witness basically a man being forced, a Black man being forced to beat his wife until their baby falls from her, a kind of lumpen mass. Who's the observer? Well, we know that the observer he has in mind in the first instance are Black people. But when you read the portion, it also seems that he has white Americans in mind too. And he's sort of trying to get them to see that, I mean, is this the kind of society you would claim as civilized? Where this is what the father of his unborn child is doing to his partner and his baby. Is that the hallmark of what it means to be a parent? And right, and all of that is tapping into the kind of what Walker takes to be the kind of background normative horizon in which both Blacks and whites in which both stand. And then the other sense in which he seems to be concerned and is thinking about his white counterparts is, you know, the Article 4, where he says, like, you know, he says, look, do you understand the words of your declaration? And there he's clearly speaking, right? He's clearly speaking to his white counterparts. And the thought is, do you understand what it means? Do you understand the entailments that follow? And once again, this is his attempt to not only awaken his Black counterparts, but more significantly in that instance, to awaken his white counterparts to the proper entailments that follow from the Declaration and the proper entailments that follow if the freedom and equal standing of Black people go unacknowledged, right? Because the Declaration is a divorce document. And on the other side of that is the Revolution.
Right. This is a, yeah, I mean, if you're a supporter of the natural rights tradition, which most of the white audience would be, you would have to be led to a view of the right to revolution on the part of the slaves. Presumably, though, than this book would have been, was this pamphlet banned or was it just, yeah.
Yeah, North Carolina, Georgia, we get We get laws being passed against teaching slaves how to read. This, of course, is also coming on the heels of uprisings, and so Southern states are particularly energized around addressing this issue. So it was seen as an incendiary. It was seen as an incendiary text, and a number of governor in particular, I think of either Georgia or North Carolina, appealed to the governor of Massachusetts to get Walker under control. Of course, there was no intervention on the part of the governor of Massachusetts. But yes, I mean, it was an incendiary document, and it generated directly to laws that constrained the ability of those who wanted to teach slaves how to read.
On the theoretical side of things, I suppose, I mean, a couple of things you mentioned here in terms of Walker's contribution or, you know, his incorporation and transformation of some of the theoretical traditions. I mean, there's a kind of democratic Republican element to his thinking. You sort of compare and contrast his thinking with the Republican non-domination tradition, which comes to, you know, theoretical articulation in Philip Pettit most recently. But you sort of situate him in that tradition, but also in the tradition, Republican tradition of civic virtue, which I found interesting that there's an appeal to a kind of civic virtue even in this, despite the kind of circumstances that he finds himself and his and the slaves in America. So maybe you could just say a little bit about how he, you know, Walker sort of appropriates this Republican tradition as part of this broader theory of ethical democracy that you're sketching.
Right. So let me just sort of back up briefly on this. The context of the 1820s to the 1850s is that we see, in terms of institutions, we see abolitionist organizations emerging that are explicitly preoccupied with responding to slavery and practices of domination. And then we see these other philanthropic organizations emerging, often called moral reform societies, emerging in the North. And these moral reform societies were essentially about character development and uplift. So institutionally in the 1820s, 1850s, institutionally, we see the two pillars of classical republicanism, right? In the book, I focus less on the institutions and more on the figures, and I associate David Walker with the Republican tradition. And I say, look, the Republican tradition has these two dimensions to it. This one, which is about freedom as a form of non-domination. And the question then is, well, how are you going to secure it institutionally and sustain it? Well, we have to be, the citizenry has to be cultivated in such a way that they come to protect and honor these institutions, right? And they have to be involved in protecting them. That's the sort of side of republicanism that's about civic virtue. Both of these dimensions show up in David Walker and in this period of the 1820s to 1850s and African American thinking. On the side of domination, this thread in republicanism would make perfect sense as Black people are confronting slavery, that they would reach for those resources that are in circulation and argue that the hallmark of a republic is that it protects the freedom of all of its citizenry, and that to the extent that it doesn't do that, it's engaged in arbitrary power. So if the society is engaged in arbitrary power, then what are you going to do to resist and contest it? And one of the things that we see in David Walker specifically is this defense of solidarity among Black people to respond to both those reasons that are fueling their domination and to respond, if need be, physically to actors who are engaged in their domination, actual slave traders and masters and these kinds of things. And the resources for this idea of solidarity, I argue, are really derived from the civic virtue line of republicanism, because civic virtue is about putting your private interests to the side in the service of the shared collective concerns of the polity, and doing it in such a way that can protect the freedom that the polity makes possible. Well, what happens when the polity itself is divided around the protection of your freedom? And so what Walker does then is says, well, given that, I will appeal directly to my Black counterparts, since they are most likely to be harmed when slavery is active, and insist that civic virtue entails that they work in solidarity to resist the forces of domination. And so there you have the two dimensions, I think, of the Republican tradition at work in David Walker, one of which is justifying a kind of racialized solidarity.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I mean, it's a kind of civic virtue for an idealized polity, right? I mean, because when I first read it, I thought this seems kind of strange, because civic virtue, you might think, would be a pretty kind of conservative thing, right? Yours is a virtuous commitment to the regime, which itself is super corrupt. But if instead you have this view of this sort of the ethical aspirational view that you're putting forward, it's a sort of idealized polity, that the real polity that exists around it is one that certainly does not measure up, then you're going to be loyal to that higher polity. I mean, the title of the appeal has that cosmopolitan ring to it. That's a kind of civic virtue for a cosmopolitan regime that doesn't exist, but might yet exist at some point, right?
Right. So Jeff, on this point, the one thing I would say is that, so I mean, you might have figured this out from this book, and given the kinds of terms and ideas that I'm using to sort of explicate these figures, I tend to sort of reject those who want to sort of lay claim to ideas around civic virtue and character as conservative ideas. Because even in the sort of classical tradition, one's civic virtue and thus loyalty toward the polity partly hinges on whether or not you think that the Republic is protecting you from domineering practices. And if it is not doing that, then it is not clear, even on Cicero's account, that it's worthy of your loyalty. And so it seems to me that if you sort of fast forward into the American case, part of what Walker is suggesting is that the polity is betraying the entailments of its republicanism. And Walker is not yet prepared to say, well, look, we should just pick up and go and invest our energies elsewhere, because he thinks that Black people have died here and bled and this is their polity as well. So he says, so now what are we going to do to transform? Well, we need to invest our energies in our collective uplift and bring that pressure to bear on the polity, right? And so it seems to me his defense, as I argue in the book, that his defense of solidarity is really an entailment of his republicanism rather than an affront to it, so that now civic virtue, I suppose, could be deployed in conservative ways, but here there's a kind of radical entailment of it, if the ideal of a freedom against domination is the thing that one is trying to combat, right? That is to say, one is trying to combat the practices of domination.
Right. Yeah, that makes good sense. So let's move to the mid 19th century. Then you discuss the disagreement between Frederick Douglass and Martin Delaney, both already mentioned in our conversation. And I was wondering if you could sketch it here, because this is, you know, this is a moment, I think, in your book, maybe that's, you know, the moment of disagreements. I mean, in large part, a lot of the book is sort of, you know, there's a lot of agreement among these thinkers. Here you get definitely a disagreement. Delaney's much more pessimistic about integration, democratic faith than Douglass. So maybe you could just talk a little bit about their disagreement and what accounts for their disagreement.
Right. So Martin Delaney and Frederick Douglass had previously worked together as co-editors on Douglass's newspaper. And in the 1850s, they begin to go their separate ways, and a disagreement around how to understand the United States and the possibility of it morally and politically transforming as it relates to slavery. A disagreement between Delaney and Douglass opens up here. And Martin Delaney, in particular, in his 1852 book, Condition, Elevation, Immigration, and Destiny of the Colored People of the United States, in this book, Delaney tries to offer up a defense for immigration, why Black people in the North who are free should pick up and go elsewhere. And his argument is that when you look at the Fugitive Slave Law, which passed in 1850 and is a kind of correction for the 1793 law, but that when you look at the Fugitive Slave Law, it really reflects the civic and ethical identity of the United States. That for Delaney, the United States comes about, and its civic and ethical identity is sort of premised on the domination of non-whites, in particular Black people. And on that kind of description, Delaney says, "Look, we are alien to them, right? That Black people are alien to their white counterparts, and the privileges of the society." And that given that that's the condition, the sort of civic and ethical condition of Black people, it only makes sense that they're going to provide for their elevation, right, which is part of this title of his, they need to go elsewhere. If they go elsewhere, then they can help sort of found their own community in which they participate in the decision making of society, and thus have a standing in that society. Douglas disagrees profoundly with Delaney, and he disagrees profoundly with Delaney is because Delaney, in that argument that he makes about the Fugitive Slave Law, Delaney thinks that, look, you can have a society pass laws, and those laws can be legitimate if they follow the appropriate procedure as specified in their legal documents, namely the Constitution. But those laws need not at all be informed by natural law, or what Delaney calls the moral law. Douglass never accepted that distinction. He always thought that positive law gains its luminosity, it gains its legitimacy by its connection to the moral law, and in that regard, slavery is never acceptable. And there is that's the sort of first of the critical differences between them. And then the second disagreement between them is that, Douglass thinks that part of what renders American politics legitimate is the space that it creates for contestation, the openness that it creates for the articulation of new moral and political aspirations. And Delaney just thinks that that's nonsense. And that's the other bit of their disagreement. And they sort of part ways around this. Delaney's position, there's a kind of realism to his position because he says, look, when you look at the facts around us, nothing is pointing in a good direction for Black people. And Douglass's argument, more often than not, is far more sort of normative in character, right? That there's a set of normative commitments that he thinks the polity subscribes to by virtue, in order to render itself legitimate, that Black people can appeal to, even as the sort of material conditions that they find themselves in, material understood in the broadest sense, the material conditions that they find themselves in does not seem to suggest the nation is moving in a positive or affirmative direction. But there's the disagreement between the two. And it would be a di disagreement that would sort of characterize and help define much of African American political thought that followed. And it's a disagreement that was held in a very difficult way already in 1829 in David Walker's appeal.
Right. Yeah. Is this a, I mean, is it a version of the disagreement? I guess to simplify massively about the, you know, the old question about how much is the U.S. Constitution committed to slavery? That is the positive law of the land. Does it, is it sort of ineradicably committed to a kind of slavery? Frederick Douglass in the 4th of July speech, of course, is, you know, kind of concludes after he, as you pointed out, has condemns the United States, also points out how much of an amazing contraption mechanism, you know, the Constitution is. So is this a, you know, is this a disagreement about, you know, the U.S. Constitution in particular, or I think you're suggesting that it goes even deeper, which is, I think, a thought about, you know, the relationship between democracy and constitutionalism as such.
Right. So I think it, you know, I think it goes deeper, but there's something worth clarifying here, which is that when Delaney and Douglass are talking about the Constitution, and there's a series of debates in this period about, you know, William Lloyd Garrison is central here about, you know, what the Constitution represents. I mean, is it really a pact, you know, with the devil? Is that really what this is about? In their period, though, they understand that in a very different way. They don't understand that simply, they don't understand the Constitution simply as a legal document. They also see it as an ethical document. And so the reason why I just sort of want to specify that is because I think in our own time, we don't, I think typically think about law, generally speaking of the Constitution specifically, as a reflection of our deepest ethical commitments. And that's an important difference. So to answer your question, in one sense, it is that age-old story, but that age-old story about what the Constitution represents in the 1850s was that the Constitution represents the civic and ethical identity of the society. That the society, through its Constitution, is telling you what it is at the deepest level of self and society. And this is on Delaney's idea, for Delaney, the thought is that this is a society that is telling you that what's fueling its identity is the subordination and domination of Black people. And it is only, I don't really sort of discuss this in a book, but it's only during the Civil War where Delaney begins to have doubts about this older argument or this earlier argument he was making in 1852. I mean, during the Civil War, I mean, he joins the Union Army because, well, what does the Civil War represent? If not for him, a fracture at the very core of the identity of the society in which the opportunity to rethink what it's about and who it wants to be as a nation emerges, right? After Reconstruction, he returns to the earlier position because Reconstruction collapses. But this is sort of how Delaney is thinking about this. And Douglass refuses this. I mean, he thinks if you accept this, then this is all settled. And he thinks that there are normative resources for why one ought not to accept Delaney's position.
Yeah, so maybe to just clarify for me, is that the significance of their disagreement, Douglass and Delaney's, for your overall argument about the ethical view of democracy? I mean, do you see that disagreement as sort of an ineradicable component of this tradition that extends up through, as we talked about at the beginning, the Afro-pessimism movement? Or is it outside the tradition, as it were? I mean, that sort of Delaney is, you know, like the Afro-pessimists, sort of, I guess, has, you know, is blind to the, you know, the radical possibilities of democracy.
I think, you know, I think that Delaney's position is that look, you know, these folks in 1850 have put their identity on display, and you should believe them. And, you know, this is why he says, look, all of this sort of, He says this in his text that, look, all of this quaint theory and exhausted moralizing will always fall in the face of the facts on the ground. And he thought that Douglass was ignoring the facts. Douglass, on the other hand, thought that the question of citizenship, which Delaney sees as being determined by the Constitution, Douglass thinks that the question of citizenship is not in the first instance settled by the Constitution. Douglass agrees with David Walker. We didn't discuss this thread in David Walker, but he agrees with David Walker that citizenship in the first instance is really about our capacity to render judgments about the communities to which we belong. And yes, we would like that capacity to render judgments to be institutionally affirmed in the constitutional order. But it being institutionally affirmed in the constitutional order is not what brings it to life. The colonists already understood this as they contested the monarchical power of King George III. They already understood this. And Douglass, in some sense, is making use of those normative resources to suggest to Delaney, look, this is not settled just simply because our white counterparts are in charge. That part of what legitimizes the entire republic is the extent to which it can be sufficiently agile and responsive to claims that it did not, that it may not have always had in view for itself, right? And of course, you know, Douglass wasn't alone in this thinking. I mean, this was, you know, this was Lincoln's position in responding to Taney's a Dred Scott decision, right, about what was held in reserve in the Declaration to be sort of pulled out at later times, suggesting that, you know, what the United States can be is always potentially in excess of what it may be at any particular moment.
I wanted to touch on a chapter where you discuss this sort of relationship between aesthetics and politics, and you do it in quite an intriguing way by drawing on Walt Whitman, his Democratic Vistas text, and connecting it with Billie Holiday. So I was wondering if you could sort of draw that side of the theory out. I mean, this is more on the sort of practice side, but it really has an interesting resonance with theory, how it is that sort of art and can intersect with this sort of democratic imaginary.
Right. So we're in chapter five now, and this is a point of the book where we have now moved to a place where we know that African Americans have a series of, or they have an aspirational view about what the United States can be. And there's a question about, well, how do they think about, what are their thoughts about bringing the existing society in line with these new aspirations? There's a thread in the book about the emotions and sentiments that are central to human life. And then there's a thread about us as sort of unfinished aesthetic projects. And so part of what I needed in that chapter was some conceptual resources that could help us gain traction on what someone like Billie Holiday is doing. What she's doing in the 1830s as she is singing A Strange Fruit, which is a song about lynching. How do we understand what she's doing? And it seemed to me that Walt Whitman's Democratic Vistas and the connection he draws between aesthetics and democracy and the way in which democratic life is not merely about the sort of compelling character of reasons, but it's also about the sort of pictures that we paint of societies, of the society in which we want to live, that then can elicit from us, draw out of us, a kind of attachment to that society. And then the thought was, well, if pictures of society could generate attachment, might pictures of society already also generate revulsion? Well, we know that in the 1890s, moving into the 1930s through the Harlem Renaissance, as Black people were grappling with lynching, that this is precisely what they thought when they themselves would redeploy lynching photographs as a way to stimulate action in the part of the audience. Might you, right, in your revulsion from this, might the question be raised, then what ought you to be turning to? And so what I provide in one of the things that I provide in chapter five is I hope, a careful reading of Billie Holiday's understanding of Strange Fruit and her performance of Strange Fruit, in which, in contrast to thinking about lynching as a form of civic and ethical sustenance for white Americans, Billie Holiday would not only sing the song, but she had a particular way of performing it that really sought to mirror the horror that one should display if one ever found themselves in a situation where they had to bear witness to lynching, whether in a photograph or, literally. This is not something that you should be smiling about and leaning toward. This is something that you should, that it should generate a cringe, and it should require you to pull back. And so democracy here, if it's a way of life, it's not only a way of life in terms of it living in our habits and sensibilities, but somatically living in our bodily comportment when we see the freedom and equal regard of persons being denied.
Yeah, I wonder if it's, if there's any connection to the tradition of the democratic sublime. I had Jason Frank on several episodes ago, but this is certainly not an issue of the beautiful, right? In the tradition, classical tradition of the beautiful and sort of the effort to ennoble human activity, but it's an effort to certainly bring out the ugliness and the horror of the world. But I think at the same time, and here's my question about the sublime element, and if you see it in here, but also an effort to see the capacity of human agency to transcend the horror and to see the possibility of rising above that, and that as the kind of engine or fuel for action. Does that resonate with you, or do you see? I'm not sure if that's the right reading here.
So I would say that is correct if we understand that the rising above, that capacity itself has to be oriented. Right. So it is, one of the things about the conversation that I stage between Whitman, Ida B. Wells, and Billie Holiday is the argument that all three already seem to be committed to a certain view of democracy. And it is that view of democracy that they then want to deploy to guide and discipline, discipline the transcendence, right? So, the reason why this is important is because these figures, the claim is not that they're putting in place, values that never existed. The claim is that the sort of normative horizon is fractured. It's in pieces, and it is not clear what follows as a result. And what they do is that they sort of piece together a kind of coherent pattern of life, that if one follows it, it then would relate you to your Black counterparts in a different way, and relate your Black counterparts, or relate Black people to their white counterparts in a radically different way. So if that's the way we sort of think about, if that's the way we're thinking about the transcendence, if there's something there that is also part of the guide for what the transcendence is about, then yes, that seems to me to be right. But these are not figures who think that the mere fact of our capacity to transcend, the mere fact of that, gets us to the normatively ennobled position where one needs to be. In that regard, I think that there's a certain kind of the deployment of perfectionism has a certain kind of Rousseauian feel to it, right? The a perfectionism that both is the capacity to rise above ourselves, but that also can be responsible for us falling below not only ourselves, but the other animals, you know, with which we share the world.
Good, that's helpful. Yeah, so let's turn to W.E.B. Du Bois. He's got his work, The Souls of Black Folk. You have a good chapter on and analyze the first couple chapters of that book, particularly by paying attention to the notion of soul. So maybe you could talk about your interpretation of Du Bois and how his account here fits in with the overall ethical aspiration of democracy.
Right. So I give the reader two chapters on Du Bois, and I sort of ask, or I sort of invite the reader, perhaps maybe anachronistically, I suppose, not, I want to get to souls, but I don't want to begin with souls. I sort of begin after. And I begin in the period of the Harlem Renaissance, because I suggest that in the Harlem Renaissance, he sort of crystallizes a sort of rhetorical and aesthetic view that is sort of latent in the souls of Black folk. And the argument is that when we read The Souls of Black Folk, one of the things that we don't pay a great deal of attention to is the idea of soul itself. That Du Bois is very much concerned with the ways in which the practices of white supremacy and exclusion affect the soul life of Black people. And he identifies the soul as that sort of aspirational dimension of human life, that portion of us that is longing for, grasping for that which stands outside of us. But that if we could achieve it, would be seen as a source of fulfillment for us. And a part of what he says is that, look, white supremacy and discrimination are deforming the soul life of Black people. And so souls, the books, The Souls of Black Folk, 1903, when you sort of read it carefully, he's attempting to offer up, in response to this defamation, a series of examples that can help fortify the souls of Black folks, that could help generate a sense of respect, self-respect, and self-esteem in them, because as they bear witness to these examples that he uses of other Black lives, that part of what they see, even amid failure, what they see is, as I argue, a kind of performance value to the struggle, right? A performance value to the life. That won't be, you know, performance value won't be enough for Du Bois. And so the other part of Souls, of course, is about Du Bois's engagement with his white counterparts, right? That his white counterparts who think, look, they're the, you know, there's a central riddle that, you know, central riddles that we're all trying to answer for ourselves. You know, who should we be and how should we live? And the thought is that human beings should have the opportunity to answer those questions. And he raises for his white readers, well, why is it that Black folks seem to, what's the issue with Black folks answering these questions? And what becomes clear is that it has nothing to do with their capacities. It has everything to do with the society to which they belong. And that speaks in the name of their white counterparts. And so all of this is meant to sort of stimulate, once again, in the reader, a sense of shame of belonging to this kind of society. That's the hope, right, on the part of Du Bois. And with those two things together, the fortification of Black folks on the one side, and the stimulation of a kind of shame about the society to which they belong on the other, that is thought to create for Du Bois the conditions for transforming society.
Good, yeah. There's lots more to be said, I think, about Du Bois, but time's running short. I wanted to touch finally on your last chapter on James Baldwin, because here you sort of take a view. You're taking us into the 20th century, and I think a lot of the theories that you've discussed are sort of forward facing in the sense that there's a kind of imagination driven by an imagination of a sort of ideal democratic future that's implicit or promised in certain kinds of institutions and practices in the United States, but sort of never realized. But I take it the question that's then raised by James Baldwin, among many other questions, is, you know, well, so what do we do about the past and where we've been and how we think about it? And Baldwin is responding to some thinkers in his time, and you see similar sort of approaches in our own time, which is to think about, well, that there's a kind of final redemption of the past, or we've sort of overcome the ills of the past, and look at, you know, kind of look at how far we've come, and doesn't that redeem some of the sins that we've performed? You could talk about, you know, Baldwin's sort of contrary view, called the critical responsiveness and response to the past, and how that's a kind of necessary component to this ethical view of democracy.
Yeah, so I mean, throughout the book, I mean, in all of these figures, there's this sense of needing to deal with what the nation is doing or has done to African Americans, and to deal with this as the basis for its own transformation. This thread is active in a number of the figures. Douglass is very much active in, Du Bois for certain. But I think Baldwin makes it the sort of cornerstone of his own thinking, the sort of foundation of his thinking. And as we come to the conclusion of the book, I had always planned to do this, in part because I think I have a sense of this place to which you and I belong, this country to which we belong, is that we just sort of have this tendency. It's part of our own mythos, it's part of our own kind of civic habits, in which we're just always thinking about how our political efforts sort of redeem our failures. And how, in redeeming our failures, they lift us out of the sins of the past. And this language of aspirational politics that I'm seeing, you know, that I'm using throughout the book, easily articulates with that. So how then do I guard against that? And I had always planned to reach for Baldwin in doing this. And so against those who basically fall into the sort of trap of our own kind of mythos, Baldwin says, look, the measure of American democratic society as it relates to the status of racial inequality must be assessed by the skill with which the nation moves through, journeys through the horror of its past. And that essentially is what I call and attribute to Baldwin, what it means for our society to be critically responsive to our past. Responsive, I think, is sort of straightforward here. It's about a kind of attentiveness, a kind of attunement, a kind of tracking of that past and the way in which it has reverberated throughout the present, the way in which it has seeded, birth, the life that we now find ourselves living, and it has, in that way, both given life to something that is also deformed in various ways. And critical responsive to attach critical to it is really about how do we stand in relation to that past such that we are not consumed and overtaken by it in the way I would say that the Afro-pessimists are overtaken. And Baldwin thinks that, you know, the way, if you take him seriously, what now follows from this is not a preoccupation with redeeming the past, because those deeds have happened and they've given life to this community. The real issue is, how do you live in the light of that? What virtues, sensibilities are you cultivating to keep you attuned and alive to that? And it is that kind of practice of remaining alive to this and being attentive to it where we can begin to sort of think about progress, where we can begin to think about transformation, although none of it will be about redemption. Right?
Yeah, that's great. I mean, in some ways, I can totally see the challenge here, right? I mean, because America, in part, there's a mythos about starting oneself anew, right? Yeah. Each generation is born anew and can chart its own way in life. And this is in part from our liberal heritage, right? That you can, you know, human beings are born free, and we, and our democratic heritage, that we don't inherit the sins of our father, right? This is not an aristocratic society in which the ills of the past, you know, are born by the present. So there's that, you know, that kind of liberal side, I think, that that comes up, I think, again, in clash with I think what you're drawing out here, which is a view of a kind of democratic aspiration that necessarily extends through time. It has a past, present, and future, because the form of collective agency that's embedded in this ethical view of democracy doesn't exist at any one snapshot. It's an agent that lives through time, just like the rest of us. So, I mean, maybe we could just conclude. Maybe if you could talk a little bit about, you know, the kind of lesson from these thinkers and how it could be drawn into contemporary discourse. I mean, if you see some of those very same challenges that I just mentioned. I mean, just one form that, you know, how do you bring this kind of Baldwin insight into contemporary dialogue and make it stick?
All right. So the one thing I would say about liberalism as a tradition in contrast to republicanism's interest in domination, guarding against it, and civic virtue, one thing I would say about the tradition of liberalism and its discourse about natural rights and the powers of human beings is that the capaciousness of liberalism is always bound up with those that are speaking on its behalf. And what I mean by that is that Baldwin himself is a liberal, but he's a chastened one, right? That is to say, that he takes as part of the sort of transformative capacities of human beings, he takes as part of that the ability of those very capacities to undermine the conditions for our own excellence. And that recognition, which is then for him materialized in the case study of racial inequality, disciplines his liberal orientation that looks very different than, let's say, someone like the figure I discussed, Ganemirov. But it's also a view that looks very different than another figure that I don't discuss in the book, but it's worthy of discussing in another context, let's say Reinhold Niebuhr. If Mirov's liberal account elevates human transformative possibilities far too high and seems to lose traction on deep and profound failures that scar us, it seems to me that someone like Niebuhr runs in the opposite direction. And Baldwin is someone who is thinking to himself, well, wait a second now, I got Black folks here and we got to get on with forming a life for ourselves. So these two approaches are not going to be very helpful. They may in fact get in the way of the very thing that we claim to be attentive to. And so I tend to, you know, let's say I was now trying to write a piece on, you know, Baldwin between, you know, I don't know, Mirol and Niebuhr and Mirol. I think, you know, Baldwin's sort of liberal orientation is a chastened, and that is because I think he has a deeper and richer view of human nature itself, in ways that the more optimistic liberalism of some other figures seem to ignore. And I think that this is the dimension, this sort of middle road, as it were. This is something that I think we've sort of lost track of. And not just simply with respect to race relations, right? Race is really the case study. The thought is that you can apply this view of democracy across a whole series of issues. But I think that we have lost the ability to really sort of see the failures of our political figures, of our fellows, as not just simply these things that we can just simply overcome, that these failures may in fact be the kinds of things that scar our very identity. And that we should be able to name them as such, right? There's something, there really is a notion of sin, even if it doesn't have a kind of theological feel to it. It's about how deep it runs and scarring the self. There's something like evil, even if it doesn't have a sort of a theological dimension to it, where evil reflects a kind of ultimate violation, an ultimate expression of... I would say an ultimate violation of a set of normative commitments to which a society subscribe, in this case, United States, about freedom and equal regard. So, you know, so I don't know if in a final analysis that's useful. I think, you know, I tend to think that it is. And my hope is that the reader will see that these figures at least render our vocabulary far more limber than it has been, and put some options back on the table for us.
I'm sure it will. Melvin, fantastic book and a fantastic conversation. Thanks again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you, Jeff.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.